Okay, so Parshat Bo. This is a really interesting idea. We'll see how far we get in this idea. I would like to say, first of all, tonight is a difficult Yahrzeit. Those of you from Ramaz might already know this. We had a student here last year, a very special boy, Alex Mofsin. His sister, Daniela, who some of you may remember the story, was killed in a terrible accident. Tonight is her Yahrzeit, Gimel B'Shvat. We have dedicated, actually last year's class got together and dedicated a shelf of Sfarim, and there's a plaque up. All those Sfarim, she died in she was on a mission of Chesed in, I believe, Honduras. She was on a bus and it overturned, and so she died doing what she loved most. And although I didn't know her because Alex was here, I read up on her, an amazing girl. And it's really true from what I read. This woman really imbibed, epitomized Chesed. So the guys decided they wanted to make a special shelf of Sfarim that are about ethics and Musar and Chesed. And that's why you can always find the Sfarim, Pirkei Avos and whatnot on that shelf. There's a plaque. I hold in cases like this, it's a mitzvah, you should stop and pause for a moment. They got together and put up a proper plaque. It was just put up today because the old one was missing a few things with her Yahrzeit. And I would urge you to take a moment and appreciate, you know, what a gift it is to still have the opportunity. We have this box, which was here a moment ago, of random acts of Chesed. Random acts of kindness. Do an act in her memory. So Yahrzeit, take a petek, put it in, pick one out, do one random act of chesed in her memory. On a Yahrzeit, that's a powerful thing, even though you didn't know her, and for those of you who did, for sure. So we're going to dedicate this year in her memory. One of the stories that really impacted me when we were in Poland last year was the story of the ghetto of Lublin. Lublin, as a ghetto, was a little bit different than the other ghettos. In fact, it lasted far longer. The Warsaw ghetto was destroyed completely in the summer of 1942. The ghetto of Lublin was still around a year later, which, considering what was going on in the Nazi hierarchy, was quite remarkable. When they set up the ghetto, so one of the first things the Nazi did was to appoint a Judenrat. A Judenrat was a Jewish council. In the case of Lublin, there were 10 dignitaries. The Nazis did their homework. They picked 10 people who were the political elite, the wealthy, whoever they were. They gathered them together, the parnasim of the community, and they told them that they were going to be the Jewish council. Very often Jews didn't want to serve in this Jewish council. The Nazis would gather them all together and shoot one of them and say, if you don't do this, we're going to kill you all and just find another 10 people to take your place. And then they would say, this is going to happen anyway. You have a chance to do something for, and so on and so forth. And they appointed Chaim Rumkowski to be the head of the ghetto of Lublin. He was the head of the Judenrat. And Chaim Rumkowski, even though there are differing opinions as to whether he was a hero or a villain, if you read up enough on him, it's just a horrible story of the choiceless choices of the ghetto. His belief was that Arbeit macht frei. He epitomized that line that appears over the entrance to Auschwitz. If we work, it'll work out. We have to serve our Nazi masters if we're productive, right? By the way, that made sense. Why would you get rid of somebody that was productive, that was producing, right? Except, of course, that hatred isn't always logical. And Chaim Rumkowski, it seems, took his job a little too seriously. They printed money in the ghetto with his picture on it. They were called Rumkowskis. They printed a calendar in the ghetto with Chaim Rumkowski's picture on the different months, right? Our guide showed us a sewer with a mug and David. Right, it was centered around Chaim Rumkowski. Right, it was a Jewish ghetto. Right, they had coins. Right, that were called Rumkowskis, bills with his name on it, and so on and so forth. And he became the de facto dictator of the ghetto. He had a goon squad whose job it was to enforce whatever the policies were of the ghetto. Right, and there are terrible stories of them beating people who didn't want to go to the Umstockplatz or weren't working hard enough in the work details and whatnot. The speech that he made that probably made him most infamous was the dark day of the Lublin ghetto when the Nazis came to the Judenrat and said that they demanded 20,000 Jews. How do you decide to take 20,000 Jews and put them on the trains? By 1942, Jews understood what was happening. They didn't think these people were going to a better place. The postcard stopped, right? Word was getting out. So the Judenrat bargained the Nazis down to 10,000, and they needed to find 10,000 people. But Rumkowski's theory was, you don't want to take people who can work, because you want to be left in the ghetto with all the people who are working. right? It's the Jews who weren't working that were threatening the Jews who were working. So he makes an impassioned speech, and he says, if we don't give them 10,000 people, they're going to kill us all. Give me your children. Trust in me that I am your benefactor, and they will go to a better place. The Judenrat, the Jewish head of the Jewish council, is telling the Jews of the ghetto that they should give him their children. And he had a small army with which to follow this out. Bedlam, mass hysteria breaks out in the ghetto. People tried to hide their children. The stories that happened there are unbelievable. And Chaim Rumkowski believed to the bitter end that as long as he worked, and of course those that he was close with never ended up on the more difficult work details, and they never ended up in the Umstadtplatz. And the final epitaph to the story of Chaim Rumkowski is that he was loaded up on the last train to Auschwitz. Now, when you got to Auschwitz and you got off the train, you didn't have to be a genius. You saw the guards. You saw the dogs on their leashes let go, ripping people to pieces. You saw the weak and the old and the children going one way and the relatively strong going another. You smelled the smells. You had to have an inkling. What does a person do when he gets into a situation like that? He slows down. He observes. How do I figure this out? You know, I remember a story. Many years ago, I went to Dachau. So I found that I was going to Dachau. I read up on Dachau before I went there. And I read one story that stuck in my head. It was written by a person who actually survived Dachau. And he describes his first day. They dropped them off from buses that took them, and they ran them for like a mile and a half, right? In the terrible heat. And they got to this bridge, right? And they're running over this bridge, over this raging torrent of a river below, right? And all of a sudden, out of the blue, right, this SS guard slams this prisoner in the side of the head with his rifle butt and knocks him over the banister of the bridge into the river below, right? And he lands in the river, bruised, injured, like managed to get a hold of his footing, gets to the bank, and realizes that the people are being ran into the camps of Dachau. And he understands instinctively that he has to get back on that line. Because if he's out, they're going to see him and they're going to kill him. He's figured that much out already. This is early in Dachau. Dachau was one of the first concentration camps. So he scrambles to get up. He has to get by a couple of guards. And he manages to get back in the line. At which point he realizes he's panicked. Because he can't figure out what he did to cause the guard to jam him with his rifle butt in the head. And if he can't figure out what he did, then he's going to do it again, and he'll get killed. He'll get injured. So he's desperately trying to figure out what it was that he did, and he's observing, and he's watching everything. And he watches someone who is ordered to go on the ground and start drinking swill from a puddle, and the fellow isn't quick enough, so the guard butts him in the rifle head. So when a guard comes over to him, before the guard can finish the sentence, he gets down to the swill. He doesn't get hit. He starts to observe. Eventually he figures out there was no reason he got hit. Guards would just sometimes hit prisoners for the fun of it. And they actually delighted in the fact that prisoners couldn't figure out what they'd done wrong. Just cruelty for cruelty's sake. But he was observing. Chaim Rumkowski gets to the platform in Auschwitz. He's entered a whole different world. He's a prisoner. But he still thinks he's the mayor. So he walks over to an SS guard and he demands to see the camp commandant. He's the mayor of Lublin. He's the head of the Judenrat. He's a somebody. They've made a mistake. He deserves special treatment. And according to the urban legend, the guard pulls out a pistol and shoots him in the face. Sometimes your reality is so much a part of you that you can't detach yourself from the way you see the world. And I'll give you an example. There is a fascinating pasuk. This week is Parshat Bo, portion of Bo. It's the last three plagues. We mentioned this, Libriot, we mentioned this last week. Right? It's the last three plagues. We get up to the tenth plague, Makat Bechorot. Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Paro and he says, on this night, Kechatzot halayla, kechatzot, bechatzot. At midnight, no less than God himself is going to come into Egypt. And every firstborn is going to die. Makat b'charot. Okay? All right. There's a pasuk here that is absolutely mind-blowing. Vayhi b'chatzi alayla. This is Perek Yud Bet Pasuk Chavtet. 12, 29. Vayhi b'chatzi alayla. V'Hashem yika kol b'chor b'eret Mitzrayim. Hashem smites every firstborn in Egypt. Every Egyptian. Mi b'chor paro hayoshev al kiso ad b'chor ha-shvi asher b'beit abo. The firstborn of paro and the firstborn of the lowliest slave in the pit. V'chor b'chor b'ema, every firstborn animal. Vayakam paro laila. And paro arises. Hu v'chol avada v'chol Mitzrayim v'tihi tzaka gdola b'Mitzrayim. Kein bayit asher in shamet. There is a great cry. The screams fill the night. So Paro gets up. What do you mean Paro gets up? What do you mean Paro gets up? Right? Vayakam Paro laila. He gets up in the night. So Rashi, chilling comment. Vayakam Paro mimitato. He gets up from his bed. What does that mean? What does that mean? Why does Rashi say that? If Paro has to get up from his bed, what does it tell me? He was asleep. He was asleep. That's unbelievable. Moshe Rabbeinu comes to you and says, Hashem is going to shecht every firstborn of Egypt unless you let the Jewish people go. Paro's son is a Bechor. By the way, you know who else is a Bechor according to the Medrash? Paro. And Paro goes to sleep? We're not talking about blood. We're not talking about frogs. We're not talking about the third. We're talking about the tenth makah. That's three times three. Three chazakot. Three times Moshe proved that an assumption happens. Nine plagues. You've got to be out of your mind. He goes to sleep? How could you understand that Paro goes to sleep? So the Kutzker Rebbe, Menachem Mendel of Kutzk, says an unbelievable thing. He says sometimes, you know, Paro was the real deal. You know, today we don't have real Apocarson. We don't have real atheists, you know. Real atheist. He's an atheist to the bitter end. Like, no matter what happens, he's an atheist to the bitter end. Right? You know, you have certain people in today's world, they don't let the facts get in the way of their reality. Right? And that's Paro. Paro lives in a world where nature is the source, and Paro is a god, and idolatry rules the world. And nothing he sees. Remember last week we talked about Makat Parad, and we said that after the Makat of Hail, Paro says, Chatati apam, v'Hashem hu atzadik. And we said that Paro says, I'm mistaken, and God is righteous. Hakarat achet, he recognizes he made a mistake, maybe even charata, maybe even regret. But he can't go that extra mile. He can't do tshuva. Why? Because he can't change the way he sees the world. So, despite all the evidence to the contrary, despite all the reality around him, he goes to sleep. Now, by the way, if he was just not releasing the Jewish people, you could make a case for saying his ego won't let him do it. But if you can go to sleep, then you're convinced that this is just an aberration. Moshe's a Jew. He can't change the way he sees the world. The whole goal of the whole journey of the Exodus in Egypt is to change the way people see the world. Why am I bringing all these plagues? Why am I bringing all these miracles? So you can tell your children and your children's children what I did to the Egyptians. That the world is different. That it's not might makes right. That nature doesn't rule the world. Fire and water mix and hail. Nature is not the source of reality. We spoke about this last week. Paro cannot change the way he looks at the world. And I'll tell you something else that's interesting. Right? What does it mean that Paro hardened his heart? It doesn't mean anything. Hashem says at the burning bush, I'm going to harden his heart. So if Hashem hardened Paro's heart, what's the obvious question? How could Paro be held accountable for hardening his heart? He has no freedom of choice. There's an unbelievable Ramban, powerful Ramban, worth thinking about. The Ramban takes note of the fact that in the first five plagues, it says, Paro hardened his heart. Doesn't say Hashem hardened his heart. Only in the sixth plague, in the last five plagues, does it say, right, that Hashem yichbid et lev paro v'et lev avadav. Hashem hardened Paro's heart. So what's going on? Says the Ramban, every person has the ability to choose. But when you make choices, they inevitably limit your choices. Right? You can make choices that limit your ability to choose. You can choose evil to such an extent that you no longer have the ability to choose good. Think about a drug addict. A person doesn't walk into a room and say, I want to get addicted to heroin. Because it's fun, because I've seen the movies. A person takes heroin and believes that he won't get addicted. He wants to experiment, he wants to escape. He doesn't think he's going to get addicted. He makes a free choice. It may be a choice for the wrong reasons. It may be a choice coming from a poor perception. But he makes a choice. When a person's an addict, he's not choosing to take heroin. He has no choice. He's addicted. You can't tell a person who's addicted to heroin, you need to stop. It's pointless. He can't stop. He's an addict. In order to help a person break such an addiction, right, he has no freedom to choose. You have to choose for him. So you push him into a rehab center and you take away his drugs. You actually detox him until eventually he recovers the ability to choose. You can make choices that limit your ability to choose. Every time you make a choice in the direction of evil, you push yourself away from the ability to choose good. Paro had taken a path of evil to such a degree, he was no longer able to choose good. By the way, you don't have to go back 3,000 years to look at this. You could look at the modern world. You know, Arafat is a great example of this. Ehud Barak comes to Arafat in 2000. In the year 2000, Bill Clinton was president. They met at Camp David. And Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak offered Yasser Arafat an unbelievable deal. One could make a case for saying it was an unethical deal. I'm not sure the Jewish people approved of it. But okay, the Prime Minister of Israel offers Yasser Arafat. You ready for this? 97% of all of the area of Yudah and Shamron. If you say that what the Arabs want is to return to the pre-1967 lines, he said, we're going to give you 3%, 97% of Yudah and Shamron. Almost everything you want. 3% is places like Efrat, Ariel, that are such big areas of Jewish settlement, it was impractical to give them and no reason to. And we're going to give you another 3% of what you call Israel proper, because it's pre-67, and it was part of Israel and the partition plan. We're going to give you the triangle, we're going to give you whatever. So you're going to get everything you want. We're even going to give you a symbolic return of refugees, whatever you offered him. Now you're Yasser Arafat. 97%. 97%. You're going to get almost everything you want. And you know what? Even if you feel in your heart you still want to make war in Israel, it would still be the smart move to take that. Take it, gain the strategic high ground, have your own state, arm yourselves, create an army, build up your economy, people will recognize you, you get tons of money from Saudi Arabia and Terra, everybody. Israel will support your economy, and then 20 years down the road, you'll be so much stronger in a better position to make war. What does Arafat do? He says no. It's not logical. Hitler, at the end of his life, made choices that made no sense. What was the Nazis' biggest problem? By the summer of 1944, their supply lines. The Russians were surrounded. It surrounded the Nazi blitzkrieg. MacArthur was beating the Japanese. Dwight Eisenhower, D-Day. But the Nazi troops were formidable. If you know the story of the Battle of the Bulge in December, they almost turned the war around. What was the big problem? Why did they really lose the war? Because of their supply lines. And that's what all his generals were telling him. What does he do? He takes all of his trains and he diverts them to take the last 400,000 Jews from Hungary to Auschwitz. It makes no sense. It's illogical. Let those 400,000 people serve the war effort, supply your lines, win the war, and then kill all the Jews. It makes no sense. He was incapable of choosing good because he had taken a road so far down evil. Every time we make a choice, we limit our choices. By the way, the good news is the opposite is also true. Every time you choose good, you limit your ability to choose evil. Right? The Yetzer Hara has a range. Right? If the Vilna Gaon is walking by a McDonald's, it's open on Shabbos, he doesn't struggle with whether to have a cheeseburger. That idea is off the table. You know, I was talking to some of the Shana Bet guys, we're having a shiur, And we're talking about the Midav Netzach. You know, it's interesting in a writer, you know, different personalities here. And it's always fascinating to me how some of us look at the same topic from different perspectives. So Rabbi Aaron, he loves the Kabbalah approach. I'm not a Kabbalist. So he talks to you about the Sfirot. What are Sfirot really? They're attributes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I always looked at the Sfirot as Midot, character traits, right? So there's chesed, loving kindness. How do I develop chesed to mimic Hashem? There's gvura, discipline. How do I develop discipline to mimic Hashem? There's tiferet, which is emet, truth, balance, right? What's the fourth midah? Anybody know? Netzach. What is netzach? Nobody ever talks about netzach. You know what netzach is? With apologies to the few Shana Bek guys who are there. There are two words. There are two different definitions for the concept of netzach in Judaism. Okay, netzach means eternity. Netzach, netzachim. But netzach also means nitzachon, victory. What is the connection between victory and eternity? What you want to do is you want to be victorious over certain things forever. You got to take certain things off the table. You got to put certain things in the netzach box. You can't always be struggling with everything. You know, when I was a kid, right, I was all over the place. I struggled with sitting. I have vivid memories of first grade, Mrs. Daniels. Oh my God, shoot me. How do people sit? Right? And she would talk to us for like 40 minutes. How could you sit? You're 6 years old for 40 minutes. Today, Baruch Hashem, after being in Gush, listening to a lechzin, I don't have a problem sitting. That's off the table. I don't worry about going to a lecture if I'm going to be able to sit. Because I'm not a three-year-old anymore. There's certain things we take off the table. Imagine you're sitting in a class and somebody sits in your chair. You start arguing over a chair. Like, you know, you're 19 years old. You're done with that. There's all sorts of things that we take off the table. We get to decide, what are the things I'm going to take off the table? What are the things I'm going to take off the table? Right? You know? My parents took certain things off the table. When I grew up, I never ate treif. I don't think I've ever eaten treif, at least knowingly. Right? So, like, cheeseburger for me is not a struggle. It's off the table. I don't have that battle. My battle is potato chips. Okay. It's a different struggle. You make choices in your life that reduce the ability to choose. If you create certain habits, if you practice proper speech, you can take, I don't know, foul language off the table. If you practice Binyan L'Chaveru, you take it off the table. Right? And that's what's going on here with Paro. And I'll just finish with one idea, because it's interesting how challenging this is. You know, in 1914, right, there was a fellow named Arno Penzias. Arno Penzias was a young astronomer in Flagstaff, Arizona. And they discovered, some of you may know the story, they discovered sort of a glow of light somewhere in the sky. And they were fascinated by this because they thought maybe this was another emerging galaxy. And discovering a new galaxy that was emerging, being created, you know. So they looked at telescopes, whatever. He discovered to his disappointment after months of research that it wasn't an emerging galaxy. It was a galaxy, but it hadn't been charted before. And he named it, he got to name it the Andromeda Galaxy. Okay, right? About 6 months later, 1914, he realized he'd made a couple mistakes in his calculations. He wasn't sure if he had it exactly right for the sake of accuracy in a paper he was writing. So he went back to take a close look at this galaxy. And he discovered something fascinating. He discovered that the galaxy wasn't exactly where he'd left it. It was actually moving. So he thought maybe he'd made a mistake. He started to measure and he realized that this galaxy was actually moving. It took him almost 6 more months to realize that the galaxy was moving approximately 700,000 miles an hour. Now, 700,000 miles an hour in the space of the universe is a micro dot. I mean, you're talking about millions, trillions, billions of miles. But it's still 700,000 miles, right, that it moved, right? So he became fascinated by this. And he started to study other galaxies. Around this time, Albert Einstein came out with his famous theory of relativity. The whole world went gaga with all of its implications for space and time and everything else that was going on. There was a Danish physicist, I believe, by the name of Willem de Sitter, who in 1914 did a study of Albert Einstein's theory of relativity and wrote a very detailed paper on it and actually sent the letter to Albert Einstein suggesting that if this theory was true, it would have to mean that the universe was expanding. At the time, there were two, you could debate three models of the existence of the universe. To break it down simply, one possibility is the universe was static. The universe just sitting. It always was there, it'll always be there, it's static. The other possibility is that the universe is actually expanding, right? Now, the problem with an expanding universe is if it's expanding, it must have started somewhere. And if it started somewhere, then you got to figure out how it started, and maybe there's something that caused it to start, and that raises all sorts of theological questions. So most of the scientific community preferred a static model. De Sitter said, the static model doesn't work according to your theory. There was a second scientist by the name of Alexander Friedman in Russia, who in 1918, unbeknownst to De Sitter, wrote a paper with almost exactly the same conclusions. He sent a very detailed letter to Einstein. Interestingly enough, Einstein didn't even react to Wilhelm De Sitter. There were big debates. It was World War I, whatever. Eventually, he realizes that they're suggesting that the universe is not static. It's very clear that he resisted this possibility because of its implications. In 1925, Edwin Hubble, who you might know the name, famous for the Hubble telescope and astronomy and everything else that's going on, right? So he proved that every star system, every galaxy, within, I think it was 300 million miles, okay? Within 300 million miles, we're all expanding. They were all receding, and they were all receding at the same pace, at the same rate, and he was able to trace where they were receding from and realized that the world, the universe, had started from a singular point. And this was the beginning of the idea of the Big Bang Theory. Now, the problem with the Big Bang Theory is, if all of matter is condensed into one singularity, into one point, the question is, what causes that point to explode? Right? There's no matter or energy external to that point, what caused it to explode? Okay. If you want to say it was unstable and that caused it to explode, right? It's an interesting question because we have the law of inertia that if nothing's acted upon, it will stay in inertia forever. So there were basic ideas of physics that were challenged by the idea of an expanding universe, right? So they came up with another theory. The other theory was the universe was expanding, but eventually it would slow down and it would retract and recede, and then it would form back into a singularity, and then it would happen again. And so the universe is static, except instead of static like this, it's expanding and contracting. Right? The Big Bang, the Big Crunch. The Big Bang, the Big Crunch. Then comes the interesting problem. In order for this to work, there has to be enough condensed mass to cause the universe, enough gravitational pull, to cause all the mass in the known universe to eventually slow down and recede and create the Big Crunch. So they begin to measure, and they discover that they're missing a lot of mass. In fact, they were only able to discover 10% of mass in the universe without getting into the ratio of hydrogen and plutonium, whatever else is going on there, right? They're missing 90% of the mass. That's a lot. According to some studies, as many as 3,000 times the mass. Then begins the most fascinating part of this whole story, which is why I brought this up. The search for the missing mass. And you read articles, you get a sense that the scientific community was desperate. They were in a panic to find the missing mass. So maybe the mass is hidden in black holes. Maybe every star has other stars behind it that we can't see. Right? Maybe there's antimatter. All sorts of different theories. It must be there. Because if it's not there, then the universe exploded. There was a big bang. By the way, the Big Bang Theory, personally, not that... who was it? Wilson? Penzias? No. Wilson and De Sitter, who was it? In 1965, I think. But I could be getting the dates wrong. Right? Discovered the degree frequency. They started hearing that there was a background noise. They couldn't get rid of it. They went to other cities and they saw it was still there. They discovered eventually, they were fascinated by this, that it was coming from outside their galaxy. And they eventually discovered, I'm making a long story very short, that they had discovered the frequency of sound that was the echo of the Big Bang. They won the Nobel Prize for this. So that's how the Big Bang Theory became the prevalent theory. Now, I don't have a problem with the Big Bang Theory, right? Hashem created the world. On the fourth day, Hashem says, the sun, the moon, right? The world is created in 6 days, 7 days. Fourth day, Hashem creates the sun. On the first day, Hashem creates light. What's the light of the first day if the sun isn't created? It's energy. It's energy. We have light all around us without a sun. So for all I know, that first day is the Big Bang. It doesn't bother me, right? The question is, if there's a Big Bang, what's a banger? And what fascinates me the most about this is how the scientific community is desperate to find that missing mass, because the most obvious conclusion, that the way they're looking at the world is mistaken, is too difficult to contemplate. And don't make any mistake about it, because that may sound like an arrogant statement. We do this all the time. We do this all the time. We have our view of reality, you know, and it's very hard for us to change the way we look at reality. If you're a left-wing politician, then you're going to stick with the two-state solution no matter what they do.
And if you're right-wing Eretz Yisrael HaShleima, then no matter what happens, that's the way you're going to go. Perhaps the message of Paro waking up in the middle of the night is that sometimes you have to slow down. And you have to ask yourself what you let go of and what you take off the table. And are you seeing the world the way it's meant to be seen? You know? It's so easy. You go to college, you're sitting in a reality. People see a different world. It's a different world. And I'm not talking just about the extremes. You know? There's like a mitzvah to get drunk. It's a mitzvah to get drunk. You're in college. That's part of the experience. To believe that that's actually problematic goes against the flow. It's hard for people to see a different reality. The challenge, you will meet many people who believe that this reality here, sitting in the Beit Midrash, this is the illusion. This is the bubble. Now you're going to go out in the real world, you're going to see the real world, you're going to rediscover reality. It's sometimes hard to explain to people, you actually discovered reality. And you're going back out into the world of illusion. And you have two challenges. The first is to maintain your grasp on reality. And the second is to share a different reality with a world that so desperately needs it. So that's a little food for thought. Much more to talk about. Bezrat Hashem next week. I wish everybody an awesome Shabbat. Shabbat Shalom.